Hi, everybody. I'm Beatty Cohn-Vredos, and welcome again to the Ask Beatty Show. And believe me, these days, I think now more than ever, we all need people who we can talk to, who we can express our concerns and our worries and our anger and our fears. There has just been so much going on, particularly in the last few months with the coronavirus situation. But even before the coronavirus pandemic, we have to look at the reality of what's going on mental health-wise in the world and in the United States. For example, there are approximately 350 million people, 350 million people worldwide who are suffering from depression. In the United States, 16 million adults in the United States, which translates into 1 in 5 Americans. And even though I haven't got the most recent statistics, you can be sure that these numbers have escalated in the last number of months. And 40 million adults suffering from a variety of different kinds of anxiety disorders. Things have been really, really tough for what I've seen, the majority of people, not only my patients, but my friends. We're all trying to figure it all out, to figure out the new normal. And if you're looking at suicide attempts by young people, have quadrupled over the last 6 years. And since 2011, there has been a 40% increase nationally for self-poisoning by young people. You have to ask yourself, what is it that is going on in this country where young people in these kinds of numbers are wanting to kill themselves? And also the suicide rate for kids between the ages of 10 to 24 increased by 56%. Homicides by intimate partners increased by 26% from 2010 to 2017. So we have to really ask ourselves, you know, with all the domestic violence awareness programs and relationship education programs, what is going on? And then, of course, we need to look also at the reality of the divorce rate in this country. 48% of couples divorce after marrying for the first time. For second marriages, that number goes up to 67%. And what about couples who are wanting to find forever love for the third time? You may be surprised to know that that divorce statistic is 74%. That's 74% of third marriages end in divorce. And with the pandemic, look at all the other issues that have risen for people. People are worried. Can I pay my rent? Can I buy sufficient food for the family? Am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my business? What if I contract the virus? For so many Americans, they don't have health insurance. And for people who do have health insurance, will my health insurance plan, will it cover catastrophic illnesses? And let's not forget about the social isolation. And am I going to need to apply for unemployment insurance and for, you know, families that have young children? Am I going to send my children back to daycare and the reality of homeschooling? How am I going to be able to juggle my work, my parenting responsibilities, homeschooling? This has been probably in the last number of years, you know, one of the most difficult times that we have all been going through as a country and also worldwide. And, you know, the way I kind of look at all of this, you know, trying to see, you know, what are the positives? What have we learned from this really unexpected crisis? And I really believe that it is a time for all of us to reflect and to reevaluate our lives, how do we want to live, and to reevaluate our relationships, and hopefully be able to reset and find a new normal. And I hear this from a lot of people in New York City who are wondering, you know, do we really want to live here? Do we want to move? Perhaps the jobs that we thought were so important, are they really all that important? So I think that during a crisis, and I've always found that crises happen to be the really best time for people to look at their lives and reprioritize and to stop. And I think the pandemic, it has really forced us to stop. So many people are now working from home. And, you know, for those people who are working from home, statistics are telling us that about 50% of people, and I was talking to a patient of mine yesterday, are more anxious and more depressed and feeling more and more disconnected. You know, this one woman who has worked at her job on Wall Street for over 25 years, you know, she was saying that she misses, she's lucky enough to have a job, but she misses getting dressed up. She misses putting on her high heels, as foolish as that may sound, and just interacting with colleagues and people on the street. And, of course, things are now starting to open up more, although, you know, I look around the streets of New York City, and, of course, people were still expected to be wearing masks and to be keeping social distance. But it's been quite a time for all of us. There has been an increase in the use of alcohol, 75% increase, wine, 66% increase. People are exercising less and they are eating more. And hopefully with the nice weather, we're going to be able to get out and take walks around the block and start to connect with people over and above Zooming and Skyping, which of course has been a saving grace really for all of us. We have not had any real alternatives until very, very recently. But I would be remiss to not mention that on Saturday, this coming Saturday, June the 20th, there is a mass poor people's assembly and moral march on Washington, which is a national call for moral revival, led, of course, by Dr. William J. Barber II and Reverend Dr. Liz Theosaris. And what they say is that we will rise together online, of course, as a powerful moral movement. Because one of the things that we may not realize is that poverty in this country is a really significant issue for millions and millions of people. And yes, we talk about the coronavirus and we talk about, you know, what's happened with policing and with the murder, the recent murder of George Floyd. And yet poverty in this country affects so many people, people who are not able to pay their rent, people who certainly do not have health insurance, people who are really, really desperate. And what we need in this country, and I certainly agree with Dr. Barber, is that we need a moral movement where we really start to care about things more than the bigger, the better, the designer handbag, and where we're going to go on vacation. And again, I think that hopefully is a time that this is the moment where we have all been really forced to stop and really think about what the priorities are in our lives and get involved. We soon are going to have an election, and we have to be very, very mindful that it's not enough to criticize President Trump, but to be actively involved and see what each of us in our own small way can do to see that he is removed from our presidency. We need people who care. We need people who have a moral conscience, where new legislation is going to be introduced, which is going to help not just the 1% in our country, but the millions and millions of people who are finding it difficult every single day to live, to work, and to navigate their lives and their relationships. And of course, this Moral March is going to be online. So again, it is Saturday, this coming Saturday, June the 20th. You know, when I was thinking about the show today, I thought, you know, things have been so heavy. And of course, all of you know, I am a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. And typically, I talk about love and relationships and sex. And so much of these topics and issues have really taken a back seat to everything else that has been going on with the pandemic. But I decided that we need to lighten up a little bit. And I was reading in the New York Times, I guess it was about a month ago, a woman whose name is Lindsay Metzeler. I hope that I'm pronouncing her name right. And I decided that I really needed to connect with her and have her as a guest on the show today. And Lindsay is the executive producer of We Met at Acme, and we're going to hear more about that, which is a podcast that chronicles the ups and downs of dating life, particularly in New York City. And she's also the founder of Lindsay's Lunchbox. And I was looking at Lindsay's media kit, and it's really amazing. This podcast launched in October of 2017, and the analytics are really impressive. 7,500 to 10,000 downloads per episode. And We Met at Acme. Instagram earns 1.6 million impressions per week, reaches 30,000 accounts per week. So, Lindsay, welcome. It sounds like you're doing an amazing job to really reach out to audiences around the world.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is so exciting.
Well, it's so exciting to actually be talking to you. Here you are, 28 years old. You're doing a million different things. And we want to hear, of course, about you, your background, and We Met at Acme, and how you actually decided, I know you have a degree in communications, that you were going to get started in the business of love and dating and relationships.
Yeah, so I'm actually 29, which is crazy to say, almost 30. But I've always had a really big interest in love and dating. And I guess you could say I was like boy crazy from a young age and kind of a serial monogamist in a lot of ways. And I, you know, when I wasn't in a relationship, I would go on tons of dates. Because, okay, you know, I wanted to be in one. And I learned so much from these dates, you know, and I was like the person out of my friend group that everyone would go to for dating advice and this and that. And then all of a sudden one day I was like dumped out of nowhere, out of what I thought was the blue. And I realized that there was so much more I actually had to learn about dating. And you know, why not share it with the world? Why not let the world come along with all my journey of finding out more about dating and kind of, you know, becoming an expert of sorts in the process by talking to so many different people with so many different perspectives. So that's how We Met at Acme began. And I was like, you know, having a conversation with a friend, and I said, let's record this. And at the time, there were no dating podcasts. It was only, you know, crime podcasts and news podcasts. And I was like, maybe the millennials need something for them, you know, to relate to, because I'm such a curious person. I always want to know how people met and about their dating lives. And so I kind of created something that I would want to listen to and took it from there.
Well, people have referred to you, of course, as the dating expert and the queen of hearts. And actually, you sound like my clone. I mean, I'm older than you, but this is exactly why I decided years and years ago to become a psychotherapist and a sex therapist. And for people who may not know, when we're talking about millennials, it's people between the ages of 26 to 40, people born between 1980 to 1994. So tell me, Lindsay, what have you learned?
Yeah, well, oh, I don't even know where to start, but I've learned a ton. I think, you know, in terms of what the most important takeaways that I've learned are, I would say that if you're confused about how someone feels about you, they're not interested in you, move on. If they are into you, you'll know 100%. You won't have to question it. And I think also just like little things like about lifelong compatibility. You know, I didn't think that religion mattered. I didn't think that family relationships mattered, things like this. I think, you know, for example, if you're someone that's really close with your family, I think you need someone that's really close with theirs so that they understand why you want to let your mom, you know, come live with you when she's sick down the line, or, you know, maybe you come from similar spending habits, so you understand each other. I think it, like those kinds of things I've learned, you know, what makes a long lasting relationship. And then also just in terms of how to communicate with men specifically, I've learned a lot about, you know, not to be the last one to say something, you know, when to be available, when to not be available, which, you know, can sound like games, but are actually just, you know, useful tools based on a lot of the information I've collected throughout the years.
Well, you know, one thing for sure is that we all need a tremendous amount of relationship education. I don't know whether you were on the line at the beginning of the show, but I mean, we're looking at a divorce rate of 48% for first marriages, 68% of marriages, second marriages fail, 73% of couples marrying for the third time find themselves in a divorce court. Four women are murdered every day by their intimate partner. 1 in 10 girls are the victims of dating abuse. 21% of college students report having experienced dating violence by a current partner. So the statistics are really, really daunting. And, you know, I agree with you. I mean, that people really do need an enormous amount of relationship education. And unless we were lucky enough to learn about relationships consciously or unconsciously, you know, from our own family of origin, I mean, we're really left to our own devices, and we're not doing all that well. Now, have you found that also to be the case, you know, in interviewing people and in talking with, I'm sure, thousands of millennials?
Yes, I definitely have. I think, you know, I actually just had a very well-known divorce attorney. Her name is Laura Wasser on my show.
Yes,
and she was very enlightening when it comes to why we see millennials getting divorced and why relationships aren't working out. And, you know, a lot of us, at least the millennials I know, are afraid to have these like unsexy conversations that are so important and so crucial to have before you get married or before you get engaged. And a lot of it is about like social media these days. You want to look like you have the perfect life and the perfect marriage and the perfect relationship, and you're not doing the work and actually communicating with that person because you're kind of putting on like a show for other people. And I think that wasn't a thing that, you know, the generations before us really experienced. And so there's so many moving pieces now when it comes to relationships, and there are so many things that don't happen the way that they used to.
You know, I'm looking at an article. I'm at home, of course, now. I haven't been to the Progressive Radio Network studio. It's now over, you know, 3 months since the pandemic. But this piece that I'm looking at, Remember Our First Date, you probably saw it. I gazed into your screen. So more and more and more, I mean, people are meeting on online and on Zoom and on Skype. And what are your thoughts about that? And then I'll share my own.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. We all have our phones in our hands 24/7. So anyone that you're going to meet out, you'll probably meet, you know, on the phones as well, because we're always holding them and we're always on them. So I think having an opportunity to meet someone through a dating app or online, it's just, you know, another avenue now to up your chances of meeting someone great. I think, you know, most people online now are normal, whereas it used to be not necessarily the case. And I think if you do your research, you know, you could meet someone really great online. And I know tons of marriages that started when they met online.
No, absolutely.
What do you think?
I totally agree. You know, years and years ago when my book first came out, I was very concerned, you know, about people meeting online. But now, I mean, I frankly really believe whether you meet in a synagogue or you meet in a church or whether or not you meet online, there are actually three things that I have discovered over the years that we all need to do if we are ever going to find lasting love and never make a mistake in love again. And the first thing, and I am curious to hear about, you know, what you think about this. The first thing is that each of us needs to be in a good place emotionally and psychologically and psychiatrically. And if we are not, I believe that we are never going to be able to find lasting love, a healthy relationship with anyone. So that is the first step for me, you know, before we ought to be, you know, reaching out and maybe hoping that somebody is going to save us. We have to get our stuff together. Thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that. I think that, you know, personally, I definitely met people when I hadn't had myself together or when I hadn't done the self-work or therapy, you know, or looking inward, becoming self-aware. I had met some people, but they weren't the right people. And I think when you work on yourself and you get yourself to a really good, well place, then you are attracting the people that are right for you and best for you in your life. And I think that only happens, you know, when you do get yourself to a place emotionally that is really good. And, you know, I actually had someone reach out to me today and they said, hey, I'm lonely. I'm ready for a relationship. What's the next step that I should take? And I was like horrified by that because I was like, you can't get into a relationship just because you're lonely. You're going to end up with someone who's not good for you because that's not why you get into a relationship. You should only get into a relationship if you're happy on your own, because that's going to be someone that you don't need, but in fact you want, which is so much better when looking for a partner.
No, exactly. And, you know, I talk a lot about we have to deal with our, in quotes, skeletons in the closet and unfinished business, you know, beginning with our own family of origin. And even though we're not able to change history, there is a way, and I certainly do this, you know, with patients in my practice, to help people really emotionally work through what did and did not happen, to help them deal with the depression and the anxiety and the early child sexual abuse and the sexual issues. And unless we go through that process, we're never able to live in the moment. We always have these clouds that are looming and that we will have continually have one foot in the past and one foot in the present. And it's not sexy work. That's the point. You know, I think that people, you know, have a lot of unrealistic expectations that, love is going to take away all my issues and problems. And unfortunately, you know, it certainly can help. But as you say, the first order of business is getting ourselves into a really, really good place. How do you think your age group, this age group of millennials, generally are doing when it comes to dating and love?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it depends where you live and what you see as success. I think in terms of career, our generation is doing great. I think in terms of love, you know, it depends. Like if you live in New York City, everything is happening much later. You know, people aren't really getting married or thinking about marriage until their 30s. And I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that. I actually think right. that it's really smart to get to know yourself and to really become who you are before you get married, because otherwise it's kind of a toss-up, because you marry someone young when you're not fully developed, and then you hope that you develop in the same direction. But if you don't, you know, then you'll have problems in your marriage. And so I think that we're doing well in terms of like the waiting until we actually know ourselves. But I think, you know, in terms of, again, going back to social media, like keeping up appearances, we're not doing so well in that area, because people care a little too much about what people think and what people see. Whereas, again, the generations before us, like, no one knew anyone's business.
Exactly. And yet, you know, how do you marry someone, or how do you commit to a serious relationship when you don't really know who your partner is? I don't know whether or not you've had an opportunity to read my book, and I really will send you one. But I did research a number of years ago with 450 people in the Providence, Connecticut, and Boston area. And I'm a very bottom line person. If it doesn't work, let's just toss it. Enough with the psychobabble. And so I developed a 10-step formula that teaches people actually how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship. So it's kind of like having me in your purse, in your wallet, you know, going through a process. And, you know, the reality is that we spend way more time, and I think you probably agree with this, assessing everything in our life, our cell phones, our clothes. And yet when we think about partners and love, I'm not sure, and you tell me whether or not this rings true for you and for people that you know, we don't think about assessment. Because before I did the research and before my book came out, I would meet somebody. I would meet, you know, a guy, or I'd meet a woman, and I'd say, gee, I've met this really terrific person. This person is great. Since doing all this work, and of course I've been practicing for a long time, I would never, ever make that kind of a statement. The best I could say is that this person appears to be trustworthy and loving and wonderful and generous and terrific without going through this assessment process. So I'm curious what you actually think about the idea of an assessment process.
I love the idea. I would love to read your book. Definitely send me a copy if you can. And I would love to hear more about what is involved in the assessment. Like, how does one assess someone properly in that way?
Well, starting with it's the same kind of assessment that I do with patients, and beginning at the beginning. I want to know about your family background. I want to know what you learned and didn't learn about family relationships. I want to know whether or not there was abuse of various different kinds in your family. Now, we don't toss away somebody because they were unfortunate to come from a dysfunctional family. But what I want to hear, and what you would want to hear, what everybody would want to hear, you know, who was dating somebody who did come from this kind of a background, you know, I was unfortunate. My father beat my mother. I came from an alcoholic background, but I made a decision that I did not want to repeat history. I went to counseling. I read books. I've done a lot of work on myself because I didn't want to have the same kind of relationship and relationships that I viewed when I was a child growing up. So that is a green light to be able to go ahead. And it is important to know what your partner learned and didn't learn. And then I have, you know, a couple of chapters in the book called Skeletons in the Closet and Unfinished Business, and you're wanting to look at things like substance abuse of various different kinds, untreated psychiatric problems. I mean, what can be worse than dealing with an alcoholic or a substance abuser of, you know, various different kinds of drugs, or somebody who has untreated psychiatric problems? It is a nightmare. So I talk a lot about the signs and the symptoms that we all have to look for in order to keep ourselves safe. This is not sexy. This is not like going to a bar and having, you know, a tea party. It's serious business. I want to look at things like communication, and it's not just where are we going to go for dinner. I want to know when you and I are dating that there is a problem and that both you and I are going to be able to sit down and work through the various different issues, not to deny, not to avoid, not to kick the dog, you know, not to ghost the other person, but to be able to see, is my partner and are we as a couple able to go from A to B to C to D, to discuss, to compromise, to make trade-offs? You know, these are the foundational ingredients, you know, that make or break relationships. So communication and problem solving and intimacy, you know, not talking about sex yet, you know, is my partner capable of intimacy, caring and sharing and trust and commitment, and I love you and affection. So it takes a while. You know, my friend Diana Kirshner, you probably know Diana and her work, you know, Love in 90 Days. I mean, we've debated this for years. I don't believe you can find love in 90 days. My research found that it takes close to a year to go through the assessment process unless it is very clear that there are so many red flags that you've got to get out. Got to exit as soon as possible. Otherwise, your life may be in danger. So these are some of the things. And of course, there are other, you know, things like, you know, sex. And as you were talking about values and goals and religion and kids and parenting. And of course, we have to realize that the perfect partner does not exist. And yet there's certain things that are absolutely not compromisable. You know, communication and chemistry. You know, I joke, Lindsay, I can teach people almost anything sexually, but I certainly cannot teach chemistry. You know, so, you know, it's a serious process. And but it keeps us safe. And that's what's important.
Yeah,
go ahead, sorry, ahead.
No, I feel like if I agree with you, wouldn't it be awesome to do that assessment and kind of find out? And yeah, sometimes it could take up to a year, but it's like, I feel like if I said that to my listeners, they would say, you know, how do I ask a question like that and not come off too intense, you know? And it's funny because I am never afraid of coming off too intense. I think if anything, it comes off confident. Like, I know what I want and, you know, here's what I want to know about you. But how would you answer that? Like, if my listeners were like, you know, how do I say that?
Well, you don't want to put the person on trial, and you might say something like, you know, I want you to know I came from a family where, you know, people really did not express their feelings very well. You know, things were kind of stuffed, and we talked about surface things, and we talked about jobs and school. So what was it like in your family growing up? It's very different than saying, well, did you come from a dysfunctional family? And, you know, did your father beat your mother? Or was there substance abuse? The how to say it is so important. It's not just about what to say. It's how to say it, where to say it, if to say it, when to say it, and how to do all of this well. That's a skill. It's like tennis. You really have to become practiced yourself in being able to communicate everything. And yet we need that information in order to keep ourselves safe.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great advice. And I think there's always a way to say something and make it sound like, you know, less intense, or just make it passable to say. And, you know, it's all about your delivery and how you say it. And also, if you're giving them information about you, then I think you deserve some information back. You know, it's like a question and answer game almost.
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, there was an article, interestingly enough, in Time magazine, and it was written by a woman whose name is Ilana Document. And this is what she was saying about the coronavirus. She says the coronavirus is actually changing how we date. Experts think that the shift may be permanent. So meeting people online is going to become, of course, more and more the norm. But it really forces people, I think, and you tell me what you think about this, to slow the process down, because we're not, you know, kissing and touching each other, you know, on the first date. To really get to know each other. And I think it does reduce the stress, and it allows for this process of really getting to know each other, asking the questions, finding out who is this person, you know, over and above, you know, what does he do or what does she do, or, you know, how much money does he or she make? So it is an opportunity to really slow things down and begin your assessment and find out, who is this person? Is this somebody, you know, potentially someone that I would really like to meet in person?
So you mean putting the intimacy aside, or just having it like stay virtual before having it be in person?
Well, what I find, and I'm going to tell you a cute little story that actually wasn't so cute for my patient. My patient, this woman, she was in her 30s, and she met this man online, and they were sexting and texting for a year. So she arrives at my office, and she was having some issues with depression, and the first thing she tells me, she says, Beattie, you know, I read your books, I hear you on the radio and TV, I have wonderful news to tell you. She says, I've met a terrific guy. I said, great, tell me about this guy. Guess what, Lindsay, they had never met. So I said, you've got to be kidding. You've been texting and sexting and emailing and doing all of this online. You've got to meet. So they meet for coffee, and guess what happened?
What?
They never saw each other again.
What? Because their chemistry wasn't in person.
It was nothing. It was nonsense. They had wasted a lot of time. It was fun. It was games. It was fantasy. It was hope. It was need. It was a whole bunch of different things. But when they met in person, there was nothing there at all. So what I recommend is, after you are Zooming for, you know, once or twice, it's time to get real and meet somebody for coffee, even if it means social distancing these days, and see whether or not anything is there, so that you're not wasting a lot of time. And I think it's very easy to hide behind the computer and the phone. Let's find out about the reality of this person and the reality of a potential relationship, and let's move on with the show, so to speak.
Yeah, agreed.
What are your thoughts? What are your thoughts on that?
I'm with you. There was a TV show on Netflix. I'm not sure if you heard of it or watched it, called Love is Blind. And it had people, you know, like, who hadn't seen each other start these relationships. And some of them, you know, did work out really well when they saw each other in person. But some just didn't, because the chemistry wasn't there. And I think, you know, I think that's why FaceTimes and Zooms, like, they can be good if you're seeing the other person, but you aren't always getting the whole package. That isn't to say that, like, everyone who meets in person after having a FaceTime relationship isn't going to get along. Like, who knows? But it's just, it's a more, you know, difficult situation because you don't really know the person in the same way that you would if you had started all your dates from in person.
No, exactly. And as you say, the chemistry, until there is that touch, until there is that kiss, you're certainly not going to be able to know about that, even if you are sexting, as many and many, many people are doing these days. But there was also something that I wanted to ask you about. This was in the New York Times, and this was written by someone who I know and like very much, Tara Parker Pope. And the headline was, "Should We All Take the Slow Road to Love?" And this is what she says. I'll just read you a couple of paragraphs. She says, "Millennials are going on fewer dates, having less sex, and marrying later. Do they know something about love that the rest of us don't?" And then there was a quote by a very, very famous anthropologist, Helen Fisher. She says, "The millennial generation is putting that theory to the test, opting for what the Helen Fisher calls slow love. Studies show that millennials are dating less, having less sex, and marrying much later than any generation before them. And a younger generation appears to be following in their footsteps." Do you find that to be the case with your research, with your podcast, with, you know, friends, with yourself?
Yes, I do, actually. And I think more than ever before, I'm hearing a lot from women and men who haven't been in a relationship yet and are almost 30, which I think used to be unheard of.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I guess that's the new normal in so many ways because it's harder to connect. And I blame technology. I think, you know, people are so used to just having their phone to hide behind that they're not connecting with people in real life as much.
No, I agree with you. And it is easy, isn't it, to, as you say, hide behind the phone and the computer. You know, when I was telling you the story about this former patient of mine who sexted and texted for 1 year, I think that's exactly what the two of them were really doing. It was like, why don't we just, there was no coronavirus, why don't we just get out and meet and have a cup of coffee or have a drink? You know, what was that all about for 1 year that they chose, because it was, you know, a decision that they both made, that they were not going to meet in person? And I'm not sure whether it's laziness, I'm not sure whether it's fear, but in order to find out who somebody is and isn't, we need to begin the assessment process, and we need to at some point, sooner than later, meet them in person and kind of get on with getting to know one another. You know, there was something else that I wanted to ask you about. The rules for courtship, sex, and marriage. In 2018, the median age for first marriages was approaching 30, and that's more than a 5-year delay in marriage compared to 1980. And a 2017 study in the Archives of Sexual Behavior found that many younger millennials in their early 20s aren't having sex and are more than twice as likely to be sexually inactive than the previous generation. Are you finding that to be true as well?
Yeah, I definitely am finding that to be true. You know, I think it all goes back to, like, just not really connecting as much. But it's funny, when we talk about, like, our generation not having as much sex, what's funny to me is, like, you know, my parents' generation, my grandparents' generation, they had, like, one phone line that they had to share with their family, and they had all this, like, trouble actually getting in touch with each other, yet they were having more sex. I don't understand.
So what do you think this is about? I mean, I see a number of people in your age group, And that's what I'm finding, too. I'm finding that there is much less sex, and I'm also finding that people have a lot more sexual issues than I found in previous generations. More hang-ups, less sex. I'm just not sure really what to make of all of this. Less comfortable, not so concerned about STDs. I think that with the whole Me Too movement, I've found that with men are not so sure. Should they be making the first move? Should there be consent? At what point should the man say to the woman or the woman say to the man, yes, it's okay to move from kissing to touching my breast, to touching my penis? I mean, are you finding that also to be something that may very well be getting in the way of just normal, fun, healthy sex life?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do. I think people care a lot more about everything today, you know, whereas it was a little bit more carefree back in the day. And I think, you know, men especially know that they're kind of under a spotlight, and no man wants to be accused of something that he didn't intend to do. And no woman wants to be in a position where she didn't feel like she was giving consent. So I think that is 100% on people's minds now. And it's a slippery slope. So everyone, you know, wants to make sure that everything is okay, and lines can get blurred when alcohol is involved. And, you know, I think we feel like we are under kind of a microscope as a generation, because everything is so easily put online and kind of going viral.
No, it's true. And, you know, I've read, you know, a number of articles. On the one hand, where women are saying, it's enough already. I just want you to approach me, take the initiative, let's make out. Don't ask me, you know, every step of the way if it's okay, if it feels good. It's really getting in the way of the excitement. And yet, on the other hand, with everything that's gone on, you know, with the Me Too movement, which I think has been terrific. I mean, you know, I think it's been really, you know, important that these issues are out there and that we're talking about them. It has, as you say, it's really affected the spontaneity in a lot of ways. And people seem to be a lot more reticent, don't you find? To engage in
sex? Yeah, totally. You know, definitely. And I think it might have a long lasting effect. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's like when you raise boys now, you have to tell them about consent, I think, in a way that maybe parents never thought to tell their kids.
For sure. Absolutely. For sure. And, you know, your listeners to your podcast, is this a subject that comes up, an issue that comes up? I know it's 80% women and 20% men, where women are either complaining that consent is not being asked, or complaining, on the other hand, that it's being asked too much and really getting in the way of the fun and the spontaneity of having a sexual relationship.
Yeah, I think it's really hard to find a balance, you know. There are some people, maybe they have like a fantasy of, you know, a man dominating in some ways, and maybe they don't feel like that fantasy can be fulfilled, or,
right,
you know, like anything like that. And maybe, you know, some women don't think men are acting like men, or what image they have in their mind as what men are and how men should be. And, you know, there's toxic masculinity, which is horrible, but maybe there are some women out there that don't think there's masculinity at all right now. as a result of everything going on.
I hear that so much, especially here in New York City. It's like, where are the real men? I mean, I can't tell you how many women I hear this from. I think that we're going through a very, very new and interesting period in all kinds of ways. And hopefully sooner than later, we are going to find some balance with all of this. Do you find, I'm just sort of looking at the clock here, I can't believe that the time is going so quickly. Do you find that the millennials that you talk with want marriage, like real marriage and children and family?
I do, but not all of them. I think, you know, there was a time where most people wanted that, and now I think it's maybe 70% want that and 30% want a less traditional situation, or they don't want kids. And I think that's totally okay. You know, there are some people that don't even want a partner at all. And I think our society and how it's changed and how women are more accepted as, you know, successful and business oriented. Like, I think that has allowed for that. And that's like one of the great things about me being a millennial is that, you know, your grandparents might be like, where's your husband? That's not necessarily what your peers are saying.
And what's important, of course, for all of us, you know, I had this Zoom therapy session, of course, everything now is on Zoom for my practice, with a 30-year-old woman, and we were really talking about, you know, people have to figure out what is it that I want and need as compared to what your parents want and need for you, what your family thinks that you should want and need. It's trying to figure out what is right for me. It may not be marriage, it may not be children, and that's all okay as long as we are being authentic and honest and introspective with ourselves, and then we can go on and live a perfectly happy, you know, wonderful life. You don't have to be married and have kids to have a happy life. But it's that first step of really doing the work and figuring out what do I want and need, what do I not want and need, and getting that kind of clarity. And it's oftentimes, I mean, I find it's tough to do this on your own. Do you find that more and more people are open to therapy, to good therapy, and figuring out all of this relationship stuff?
Yeah, I do actually, and I'm so grateful for that, because at a certain point, I think there was a stigma against therapy, like, oh, you had to, you know, be crazy to go to therapy, or something had to be really wrong with you. Whereas now I think people are looking at it as it should be looked at, as a way to actually get like a leg up on people, because you know yourself, because you have self-awareness, which is, if anything, a tool that you can use to get ahead in life. And I think it has been really helpful for relationships and very illuminating to see, oh, like maybe I have abandonment issues because, you know, my dad abandoned me, whatever it might be, to get to the root of your problems. And I actually, on our Instagram for We Met at Acme for the podcast, we have a highlight where we list all the recommended therapists from polled from our listeners in different cities around the U.S. And actually some in London as well. And it's been so useful to our listeners and followers, and they always write in, you know, thanking me for normalizing therapy more and more. And I think, even in corporate situations, you know, if you say, hey, I have to go see my therapist, like you will get paid time during that, you know, hour or so during the day to go see your therapist, and some insurances cover it. And I think it's great that it's becoming more normal, because, you know, I guess now we only have to wait for men to realize it's normal and go more.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting about men is that when I've lived in different places, there have been times where 70% of the people who would call me for therapy happen to be men. And what I've also found is that the men who come into therapy with me, they're serious. They are really, really serious about getting their lives and getting their issues and really understanding themselves in ways that they never did before. And in fact, that's really the number one criteria that I ask for people, is that they are going to be serious about, you know, acknowledging, addressing, and resolving their problems. We only have a couple of minutes left. As I say, I can't even believe that the time has gone by so quickly. But what are your three top rules for dating?
That's a great question. I would say the first one, and I've gotten a lot of slack for this one, but, you know, unless you met previously, I don't think that you should have sex on a first date. Not because I'm slut shaming, but because, you know, it's fun to have this build up and this excitement. I would say the second rule is don't respond unless it's a question. Like, don't, you know, less is more when you're conversing with someone. I wouldn't, like, if you have to think about what to respond, maybe just don't respond. Like, the best response is no response. And my third rule is, I kind of said it before, and just, you know, it's a little basic overview, but if you're confused, they're not interested, move on. And those are, like, my go-tos.
No, sounds good. And don't beat yourself up. Well, listen, we are both in New York City, and things are now opening up, and I would love to meet you in person. And I will definitely email you, and you'll be able to send me your address, and I'll love to send you, you know, a copy of my book, For Better, For Worse, Forever, Discover the Path to Lasting Love. So, Lindsay Mazzelli, you sound like a wonderful, wonderful young woman. You're doing amazing things. I mean, truly, since 2017, look at what you've accomplished. I mean, it's quite something. It really is. So, congratulations on all of your accomplishments. And people
Thank
need
you
to
so,
go
so much.
To your podcast. We met at Acme, right?
Yes, check it out. Let me know what you think. Follow us on Instagram as well. And thank you so much for having me. This is such a nice conversation.
It is a wonderful conversation, and I'll be in touch, and I really look forward to meeting you very soon. So take care and enjoy the rest of the
you
day.
Too.
It's gorgeous outside.
You too.
Okay, then.
It really
bye.
Is.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right,
bye.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Well, that was Lindsay Mazzelli, and she is quite a young woman. She is the executive producer of We Met at Acme. So that is a podcast for millennials that chronicles the ups and downs of dating life, particularly in New York City. And of course, as I've been saying for years and years, we all need as much relationship education that we can find, and that we need to be in a good place. We need to learn the ingredients that actually go into a healthy relationship, and we all need to read my book. I wish I had had my book when I began my own relationship life. It teaches people how to assess who's right for you and who's wrong for you before committing to any serious relationship, so that you will never make a mistake in love again. So listen, I want to thank you all so much for listening and emailing me and texting me. And I will talk with you next week. And of course, we close with my most favorite song. And that is What the World Needs Now is Love, Sweet Love.